This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kaysen. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kaysen.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles. And everyone listening all over the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I am here with Kerry Kaysen, my wonderful co-host. And Kerry Kaysen, I got to tell you a story. First of all, nice to see you.
Good to see you.
I just said that. It doesn't really mean anything. It's meaningless. But.
I'm like, you know what? It's like unbelievably negative.
So I'm reading MSN News this week, and I'm going through the slide, the banners of all the news. And there you are, Kerry, in the news.
Yeah, again.
Again. You were right featured, like the third banner. You didn't make the first banner. I think a guy named Trump was on the first banner.
Who?
Some impeachment
thing. I'm totally kidding. No, he's always going to make the first and then
so
something
you're not
else.
Jealous
maybe,
of him?
No.
Maybe you could get impeached and then you could make
the
first.
Hey, sure, you know.
So you were in the news because apparently, and we've talked about this on our show, your lawsuit against Casey Kasem's wife, Jean Kasem, settled. No way. You actually settled that case?
No, I didn't. You know, when you have an entire team against you that tells you, you know, they're not your team anymore. You just see it. Like, there's certain things that happen that I'm not happy with, and that's basically all I can say. But I'm not happy with it, and it's not something that I would have done.
But you settled the case.
I can't say anything more, and when I can, I will say something more. That's all I can say right now.
So what was your statement? Because I did read your statement in the news, and it went to the effect that you were not happy with the settlement, and you felt that you were pressured into it.
Yeah, that's it. That's all. And that's really right now all I can say, and it breaks my heart that we didn't get our day in court and that we don't have justice for my dad.
But you have a choice. You're looking at me like
I'm going to kill you because you know I can't talk any further about this.
Right.
But you know.
Well, maybe we could get some legal advice because we have a top legal scholar.
And I'm not let's move on.
Today.
I'm going to kill you.
I'm not sure if this falls within constitutional law or the National Constitution Center, where he's the president and chief executive officer. But you may want to solicit some advice from him, because perhaps he could focus on a constitutional premise that you could rely upon with respect to whatever happened in the settlement that you won't talk about.
That's right. Maybe I'll learn something today.
Let's talk about the Fifth Amendment.
I take it. But then that kind of leaves me.
And this is nonpartisan, of course. We're not talking about politics here. We're talking about the Constitution. Okay, Kerry, I'm going to leave you alone right now.
Let you
off the hook.
We
will look forward to hearing more. I'm going to read my MSN news to find out exactly what happens with the Kerry Kaysen settlement with her father, Casey Kasem, at issue here.
Yeah, it is. But we will move on until I can say something more.
So let's talk about something that we can talk about, something that is important, something that is so interesting. So many people are so envious. I said so a number of times. So envious of Jeffrey Rosen because he has had such an incredible run with so many different things in law. And what we're talking about today is a book called RBG. Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Life, Love, Liberty, and Law. And there are very few people in this world that have spent as much time with RBG as Jeff has. He is a legal historian, and the LA Times called him the nation's most widely read and influential legal commentator. High marks. Chicago Tribune named him one of the 10 best magazine journalists in America. He's a professor at George Washington University Law School, contributing editor of The Atlantic. He's a very highly regarded journalist, of course, and appeared in the New York Times Magazine, NPR, New Republic, New Yorker. We could go on and on, but he is the president and chief executive of the National Constitution Center. Welcome to Gervie's Law, Jeff Rosen.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you because you have such a great resume, as I just articulated here. But what you said about RBG is really intriguing. You said that she has lived more successfully than any person that you know, yet you have such a wonderful resume of accomplishments. Tell us what sets her apart from everyone that you know.
She is my personal and constitutional hero. And of course, she's the constitutional hero of many people. But what's been such a privilege about having fallen into this serendipitous friendship with her that began 25 years ago is I've just come to see what an extraordinary person she is on a personal level. So just to give an example, she is the most focused, empathetic, disciplined, and productive human being I've ever met. And the core to her ability to do this is advice that her mother gave her. Her mother told her, be a lady, be independent, and always overcome unproductive emotions like anger and jealousy. And I asked her in our interviews, this is the advice of the great wisdom traditions, but it's very hard to achieve in practice. How do you do it? She said, I realize if I don't overcome unproductive emotions like anger and jealousy, I will lose precious time for productive work. And she said when she was recovering from her illness last year and was in pain and was distracted, she would focus on the importance of do the work and just do the work. That was her mantra. And as a result, she wrote her opinions more quickly, even last term, than any other justice. So there are lots of examples, and I'd love to share them with you, about her productivity and her focus. But every moment of the day that I'm tempted to surf the net or watch cat videos or, you know, do whatever I want to do to waste time, I think, WWRBG do? What would she do? And then I try to focus, try to get back into the zone and just do the work. And she's just an inspiration, and she's more successful at that than any human being I've ever met.
And that's the T-shirt that you talk about when you talk about what would Ruth Bader Ginsburg mm-hmm. do? You know, I'm looking at a quote where it says, it's our obligation to achieve deep knowledge, and you get there by deep reading rather than browsing or losing ourselves on Facebook. It's a great quote, and that's what Justice Ginsburg tells us. But how do you separate those who can focus on this deep reading and the unproductive emotions and being independent and not losing precious time for productive work? Setting aside the ego, how do you do that when so many of us, Carrie included here, are so tempted to be distracted on Facebook and to be distracted on social media and to not focus on what you learned from RBG?
It's completely human. All of us face these temptations every moment of the day. And this is the struggle throughout the history. You know, the Jewish tradition, the Christian tradition, all the great wisdom traditions, the Buddhists all talk about how do you overcome your ego and focus so you can serve others. All I can do is just give examples of how she does it, because it's the concrete examples that just inspire me whenever I'm tempted to be distracted. So just here's one. She was ill last year. I had turned in the manuscript to her because she wanted to edit it. And then, of course, I didn't know whether she'd have time for it and assumed that it would fall by the wayside. 10 minutes after the Supreme Court term ended last June, on June 27th, I got an email from her saying, I've finished your manuscript and I'll give it to you on Tuesday. And I went to the court and she was there and she handed me the manuscript, and every single page was marked up in her beautiful handwriting in pencil, changing words, correcting typos. She's the most fearsome copy editor and deadline enforcer in the history of editing, and essentially just perfecting it so that it was exactly what she wanted to say. And I was absolutely staggered. I said, how on earth did you have time to do this in the middle of all of your court right. responsibilities, in the middle of your recovery? And she said, well, I told you I'd have it, and I'd like to meet my deadlines. But how did you do it?
Wow.
Well, I did it in the back of cars, or when I was at the movies, or, you know, there's not an unproductive moment that she allows to go to waste. And I just thought of her. I mean, this is one of many projects that she's doing. It's not a significant part of her workload. Just think of this great woman with all the burdens of the world on her, making time for this and so many other things just because she said she would. And it's completely inspiring. And I think, you know, with all the far less weighty responsibilities I have, I can try to focus too. So there are lots of other examples of her doing that, and we can talk about it. But I think the only way to, you can think about it in theory all you like, but having a hero, having a human being who actually exemplifies that focus better than anyone else helps inspire me and helps me get down to work.
I was watching somebody on something on people who are obsessed, they're perfectionists at the top of their game, whether it's Bill Gates or Elon Musk or Steve Jobs. And do you think that she has an obsession with work? Because I've seen the documentary on her and she seems like she balances everything so well. But is she somebody who's a perfectionist who's obsessed with, I guess, getting up every day and doing her and working?
She is a perfectionist and she, you know, you could use the word obsessed or extremely focused, but she's not a workaholic. That the remarkable thing is she's just as focused on the cares of others and on their concerns as she is on her work. So here's another example. She was ill and the first public appearance she made last year was a performance that the National Constitution Center hosted in D.C. of her daughter-in-law, Patrice Michaels, singing this beautiful song cycle of songs by RBG. And the justice showed up unexpectedly at the last moment, and it was her first public appearance. She showed up at the performance, and my mom had passed the week before, and she'd heard about that. And the first thing she did is just walk up and hand me a handwritten note about my mom that appears as the dedication of the book, which is this incredibly beautiful statement about the loss of a parent and how important it is to carry on with your work and days. And isn't that just what your mom would have wanted? And that's just another example. I mean, she's just been going through the most extraordinary health challenges of her own. Again, she has so many other concerns. And she just took the time to write a note to me, as she does to hundreds of clerks and friends and other people that she interacts with. So the thing about her that makes her so extraordinary is it's not just her work that she's always focused on. She's completely tuned in every moment of the day on exactly what she's doing and is not distracted.
You know, it's so interesting you say it, because I think what you're talking about is not necessarily an obsession or not necessarily a workaholic, but a commitment to do the right thing. And so many people do not have that commitment. They don't have the commitment to do the right thing, to follow through, to think of others in your difficult time. And we're sorry for the passing. You know, people just don't do that. And I remember it wasn't too long ago, probably a couple months ago, when Gloria Allred came to do our show, and it was late at night, and she said she had to be in New York. It was Sunday. She had to be in New York Monday morning to do the Epstein hearing, and then the next day it was the Weinstein hearing. She didn't know about it when she made the commitment to be on our show, and she said, I decided I would take the red eye to fly overnight, even though I can't sleep on airplanes, but I'd fly overnight because I told you I was going to be here and I'm not going to cancel. And when you talk about RBG being obviously a heroine to Gloria Allred and maybe vice versa, that's the kind of commitment we just don't see from normal folk. And it's so important in this day and age that we teach that to our children.
And another thing on notes, my dad always said, write a little note. It goes a lot farther than flowers or an email. Is it just a personal note somebody will remember you by? And to this day, people will come up and say, hey, I still have the note your father hand wrote me. And it means so much to them. So now this generation, you don't ever see that. You don't see the cards. You don't see the little handwritten notes.
Well, I'm sure that Jeffrey Rosen will hold on to that note forever from RBG. Jeff, we want to talk a lot more about the book. It's called Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Life, Love, Liberty, and Law. A lot of L's in there. We have to take a quick break. We'll be back after this talking to Jeff Rosen right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Beautiful opera music. And we are speaking with Jeffrey Rosen, who is professor at George Washington University Law School and well known for being the president and chief executive officer of the National Constitution Center, author of 6 books, including Conversations with RBG, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on life, love, liberty, and law. It was said about the book, conversations make you feel like a student in the world's coolest law school seminar, with Ginsburg and Rosen deftly leading you through constitutional clauses and case law to elucidate how the court works and why it matters. And we just played some opera for you, Jeff. So tell us how a guy like you gets so tight with Justice Ginsburg after meeting in an elevator of all places.
Well, it was indeed opera that brought us together. And you were playing Carmen, and it was the music of Carmen that Justice Ginsburg comes into in the opera Scalia Ginsburg, which we can talk about later, but it did all begin over opera. So I was a law clerk a long time ago in 1991 in the U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C., and I was clerking for another judge, and a few months into the clerkship, I went into the elevator to go up to the clerk's office to get something, and coming into the elevator going down was Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she was coming down from an exercise class called Jazzercise.
I remember that. I totally remember Jazzercise.
Carrie, I'm sure, had been at a lot of Jazzercise classes.
Totally. And I think she was actually in the Jazzercise workout clothes. But she's a formidable presence, and she maintained this kind of sphinx-like silence that, if you don't know her, can be extremely intimidating. So we're in the small elevator, and I just had to think of something to say in order to break the ice. And I literally couldn't think of anything else to say, so I blurted out, "What operas have you seen recently?" Now, it turned out, of course, this is exactly the right question to ask, because she loves opera, as do I, and we just began this conversation about opera that persisted throughout the clerkship year. But it was just dumb luck. I'm not a sports guy, so I didn't ask anything about that. And the moral of the story is don't take the stairs, because it was a very faithful elevator ride.
So you had no idea that she liked opera. That just came out of your mouth.
It came out of my mouth because I do, and I just was nervous and couldn't think of anything else to say. And then we started corresponding about opera when I went on to become the legal editor of the New Republic the following year, which was another great break. And we also started talking about her judicial opinions. And then there was a vacancy on the Supreme Court. Byron White resigned. Now, amazingly, as it is to recall now, Judge Ginsburg was not at the top of the list. She was actually opposed at the time by some women's groups,
right,
who didn't like her criticisms of Roe v. Wade. And it's very interesting to look at those criticisms in retrospect, because they seem so prescient. She thought the result in Roe was absolutely right, of course, but she thought first that the original case was decided too broadly. It should have just struck down that extreme Texas law, which had no exceptions, and then allowed the political process to move in a more liberal direction. And also she thought it should have been decided on grounds of women's equality rather than the right to privacy of male doctors. Burdens on abortion, she said, impose restrictions on women that are not imposed on men. They restrict women's life choices and they violate equality. And that was very prophetic. And years later, the Supreme Court recognized that equality is a better grounding than privacy for abortion rights. But because of that, some women's groups thought that she wasn't progressive enough. Now, I, as it happened, had been to a lunch at the Court of Appeals a few weeks earlier, and the law clerks told me the following story. They told me that Justice Scalia had been there recently, and one of the clerks asked him, if you had to be trapped on a desert island for the rest of your life with Mario Cuomo or Lawrence Tribe, who were the two seats, who would you choose? And he shot back without missing a beat, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's funny.
Aww.
So I then reported that story in the New Republic, and with the incredible overconfidence of a 28-year-old, I ranked all the candidates, you know, I presume to say who was good, and the list culminated with Judge Ginsburg, and I said her appointment would be the most acclaimed since Felix Frankfurter, who turned her down for a clerkship on the grounds that the court wasn't ready for a woman. Now we are. So this little piece ended up getting picked up by Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is championing her nomination. When President Clinton on Air Force One asked him who he should appoint, Moynihan, who just read the piece he wrote to me, said there's just one choice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Clinton said the women are against her, and Moynihan was able to fax, this is 1993, a copy of the Harvard Law School dean calling Judge Ginsburg the Thurgood Marshall of the Women's Movement. And that kind of got her over the edge and helped get her appointed. So that was my Zelig-like footnote role.
It certainly was a Zelig-like footnote. How did you compare her at the time to Sandra Day O'Connor? Because Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, had started the women out in the Supreme Court. And then you have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, very different women.
Very much so. And Sandra Day O'Connor at the time was, you know, seen as quite a conservative judge and was voting with the conservatives in lots of cases. When Judge Ginsburg joined the court, Justice O'Connor was very much the swing justice, and Judge Ginsburg was more progressive. But they bonded in a way that I hadn't realized until I asked Justice Ginsburg about it. And Sandra Day O'Connor was incredibly welcoming to her. She was thoughtful about Judge Ginsburg's first opinion. Ginsburg called her the perfect big sister who kind of helped her accommodate. They both lobbied to get a women's restroom, which was the same size as the men, and it took several years to pull that one off. And really interestingly, when the most important gender discrimination case of the 90s, the Virginia Military Institute case, came up, Chief Justice Rehnquist originally assigned it to O'Connor, but O'Connor said, no, this opinion should be Ruth's, and she gave it to Ruth. So they became extremely close, although jurisprudentially they were not always aligned.
Was this at West Point?
Nearby. It's called the Virginia Military Institute, or VMI, and it was the last public all-male military academy.
I remember, and they let the woman in. Yeah.
They let the woman in, and they fought tooth and nail and said it was going to be the end of VMI, and RBG said boys will be boys, but I'm sure they'll get used to it. In fact, it worked out pretty well. When Justice O'Connor retired, RBG said that retirement changed the court more than anything that happened on her watch, and it was that began her transformation into the notorious RBG.
What is it about Ruth Bader Ginsburg that she's able to look at people who have differing opinions, may not agree with what she is a proponent of, yet she doesn't seem to get upset? She's able to be friends with them. She's able to see their positions. Isn't that something that we all can take a lesson from, especially in these divisive times?
It's called sanity, and many people don't have it. It's true. It's what it is.
Well, let's not go with the ad hominems. I want to hear
just
from the
telling you, that is called somebody
here
who's sane. And if there were more sane people in this world, we wouldn't have what CNN and Fox are doing to this country. I'm telling you that now.
Well, the question is, what? It's such a good question, because you're absolutely right. And Justice O'Connor was an important friendship, and then most famously was her completely improbable, really deep and meaningful longtime friendship with Justice Scalia. And you have to say that there's something, I find it incredibly moving to think about how close they remained, even though they disagreed fiercely. They were completely on the opposite sides of Bush v. Gore. And after the case came down, Ginsburg was stewing in her chambers. And she told the story at his memorial service. Scalia called her up and said, Ruth, what are you doing still at the court? Why don't you go home and take a hot bath? She said, good advice, which I promptly followed. And they famously had New Year's dinner together, which Marty Ginsburg, who's an amazing cook, would make. Scalia would sing around the piano. He once had two other guys singing with him and called it the really famous three tenors. And I asked her, as many people did, how did you stay friends, even though you disagreed so strongly? And she said, you know, he drove me crazy sometimes, but he just made me laugh. And he literally would make her crack up. She has a very good sense of humor. He was extremely funny. And they had been friends on the Court of Appeals, as that Desert Island story showed. And she could enjoy his humor and their shared love of opera. And they went to the opera and they laughed and they ate together, despite the fact that they strongly and vigorously disagreed. And part of it, as you said, she's sane in the most profound sense. Mm-hmm. She never allowed personal invective to rattle her. And although Scalia sometimes used some pretty slashing rhetoric, he said of Justice O'Connor's opinions, they cannot be taken seriously. And O'Connor responded, sticks and stones may break my bones. That probably isn't true. Justice Ginsburg never engaged in that sort of rhetoric because she was so keen to keep the disagreements on a jurisprudential level. And what united them in the end was their shared love of the court as an institution. And I know it's, you know, this is a time when institutions are under siege and it's easy to be cynical about them, but they cared so much about the ideal of a nonpartisan judiciary that they kept that love of the court together, even though they disagreed so fiercely in case after case. So I just find it an incredibly moving personal story because they were so loyal to each other. But also, as you said, when all of the institutions of American government are so divided and so polarized, Congress completely dysfunctional, the executive, you know, in an unusual condition, just to see these very different justices united by their love of the court as an institution.
Words like decency, maturity, being honest and not throwing out, casting aspersions. Those are things that, you know, we consider when you're telling these stories about RBG, and then we juxtapose them with what we see in Congress and when what we see in the media, and you start wondering exactly, you know, Carrie, I'm going to come around to what you said. I don't know if it's sanity or not, but it's certainly some sophistication that not a lot of people have control over and apparently aren't focused or committed to, like RBG was and is moving forward. Now, Jeff, we do have to take a quick break, but I have one quick question if you can answer. And I know, you know, I'm not doing your deposition or anything, but just try to not volunteer information because we're using it as a tease. How many people do you know of that RBG has married?
You know, I don't know the answer. I she did marry me, and I know that there are maybe hundreds.
You know,
story that I'm happy to share.
Lauren would be happy with you because you just talked about what was most important, which was you, and who cares about everyone else, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Jeffrey Rosen. The book is called Conversations with RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in Life, Love, Liberty, and Law, and you're listening to Gervie's Law. Right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
All right, we're back.
What was that? Candide? What is it?
Let's ask Jeff.
I can't quite hear it, but it sounds like Candide, Glitter and Begay or something like that.
Yeah, Glitter and Begay, exactly.
Oh, yes, so beautiful. Listen to this. RBG saw the original production of Candide. It didn't last very long, but among operetta fans, it was legendary.
It's one of my favorites.
On the road, I think in Boston. Isn't that amazing?
It's literally one of my most favorites. And when I was singing through college, I sang Glitter and Begay. It was not anything like she did, but yes.
And it's now the notorious RBG song.
It is.
Absolutely.
Did you know that? There's been so many, over the last couple of years, so much written about her. She's become a social media sensation. Two movies particularly that came out last year. One of them, the documentary RBG. We actually had Betsy White and Julie Cohn on our show, who were the executive producers of that documentary. And they talked about what a wonderful experience it was putting that together. And we are going to get to your wedding vows in a minute. But what did you think of the RBG documentary and then, of course, the theatrical release On the Basis of Sex?
I love them both. The documentary was so beautifully put together, and that original footage of her and Marty from Cornell just gave you such a sense of their love story. And of course, the unforgettable boxing workout footage, which is just amazing. No one who saw it will ever forget it. And then her granddaughter, and it was just a riveting introduction of her to the nation and the world for people who hadn't seen her before. And then the movie was spectacular, and it was written by her nephew, I think, and it was so brilliant of him to pick that Moritz case, the tax case, which she picked at Marty's suggestion to attack the tax law that gave benefits to a survivor if she were a a woman, but not a man trying
right.
to care for his deceased relative. And the actors were great, and RBG herself really liked Arnie Hammer, who she thought was quite good-looking and well-portraying yeah. Marty in that regard. And then, of course, the scene at the end where she's walking up the courthouse steps just is completely unforgettable. So they're both wonderful. They did her justice. And,
yeah.
And you know, this is another thing. It's just amazing that in 1993, when she was nominated, all of those towering achievements, this woman had did more than anyone else in the 20th century to transform our understanding of gender equality, wasn't even recognized for those achievements. All of the litigation that the movies celebrate was kind of forgotten in history. And it's an encouraging sign of how far we've come as a country that we're willing to acknowledge the greatness of this woman, whereas 20 years before, it just wasn't on the radar screen.
And having new generations learn about the greatness, that's really important. You know, when you talk about all of the accomplishments, one of them, of course, as we teased before the break, was marrying you and Lauren. So I'm sure that is right up there with her accomplishments. Tell us about the vows and when you were asked to, and I'm not going to say kiss your bride, because I guess that would be the it would be the wrong terminology from what actually happened.
I want to know what happened now.
it was a great story and another example of RBG, the proofreader and deadline enforcer extraordinaire. So, of course, I was thrilled when she agreed to marry Lauren and me in 2017. We went to her chambers. She met with Lauren and talked about her work as a professor of cultural anthropology and agreed to perform the ceremony. And she said, "Send me drafts of your vows by 4 o'clock on Tuesday in a few weeks." And she sent us samples of vows she'd used for other people. So we forgot about this deadline and were focused on other things, like whatever planning, what we were going to wear. And at the morning of Tuesday, whatever the date was, an email from RBG's assistant, "The justice is expecting your draft vows at 4 p.m. Yikes, we thought. So we rushed and kind of put them together based on the scripts that she'd used before and sent them to her. 4:30 p.m., just right after we emailed them, and this is in the middle of the Supreme Court term, an email back from the justice with her changes, in track changes in Word, inserted on the document. And in the final blessing at the end of the ceremony, we had used the traditional one, "Jeffrey, you may kiss the bride." And she crossed it out and inserted instead, "Jeffrey and Lauren, you may embrace for the first kiss of your marriage."
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, that's how it should always be. I love that. That's wonderful.
It's
a wonderful story.
It's
a wonderful on so many levels, including the fact that she had given the traditional version, if it wasn't hundreds of times, it was certainly scores of times. She'd done it before. But here it is in the middle of the Supreme Court term with everything else she's got going on. She reads it and she must, it just struck her, and maybe she changed it a few times before. We need a more gender egalitarian and embracive version. And that adjective embracive is one that she used to describe her vision of the Constitution. And it's another example of just being totally focused on whatever you're doing. I mean, she could have just let it go because she'd done it so many times before, but reading and thinking about every single word and realizing that every word we use is important is something that she does every minute of the day, and it made the ceremony all the more magical.
Critics might say that perhaps she is too opinionated and shows her feelings and emotions and thoughts on her sleeve. In conversations with RBG, you discuss with her the future of Roe v. Wade, her favorite dissents, the cases she would like to see overturned, the Me Too movement, as well as all the life lessons that we talked about, being a good listener and how to lead a productive and compassionate life. But is there an issue here about a sitting justice of the Supreme Court providing opinions on cases that maybe she thinks were wrongly decided and other opinions that may reflect on future cases that will come down before the court?
Yes, it's certainly fair to ask that. And I asked her about that, too. And I said, "What do you make of the response to those who say that your dissents are too strong. And she'd say, I'd say that it's the same criticism you can make of Scalia's majority opinions, which are equally tendentious. She's pretty careful in always to discuss her jurisprudential disagreements, which she usually makes in public in her dissents, as well as in the interviews. There are a few occasions where she seems to be kind of signaling future views. One that, believe it or not, I hadn't caught in the book until the AP and then the New York Times noticed it. She said she's talking about non-disclosure agreements in Me Too cases, and based on edits to the manuscript that she'd made after I turned it in, she said these non-disclosure agreements are unfair, and I hope they will not be enforced in court. And that's a remarkable statement. Wow. It's definitely based on the view that some of these non-disclosure agreements are coercive and don't have equal bargaining power, and for that reason might not be enforced as a matter of public policy. That's an adventurous view. It's not inappropriate. She's perfectly allowed to express it, but it shows her boldness at this stage in her career and her willingness to really make her own views about where the law should go queer. But I think that her view is that the her conservative colleagues, especially Scalia, were extremely transparent and clear about what they wanted to happen with the law. Scalia was called on to recuse himself all the time because he sort of signaled the way he was going to vote on cases. And she thinks that she has an obligation to be similarly clear.
Carrie, we have to take a break, and I know you have a lot of questions. After the break, and this is our last chance to talk to Jeffrey Rosen, and he's at Jeffrey Rosen on Twitter, we're going to do the lightning round, Jeff. So if it's okay with you, we have a number of questions. We only have 10 minutes left, a number of questions to go over. It's called the lightning round. Are you ready for that? Can you, as a scholar from Harvard, Yale, and Oxford, will you be able to handle this?
I think I can manage it. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to have a lot of questions. We're going to bombard you with questions with quick answers, and you don't want to miss that. That's coming up right here on Gervie's Law, right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
The best thing about being an orphan is the prerogative to have a little money.
Oh. All right. Well, it looks like we've moved away from opera. Is that Shania Twain? I'm not sure that she's a big fan of Shania Twain, but being a woman, I think.
It's a good song.
Qualifies.
It's a good song.
We're talking to Jeffrey Rosen. The book is called Conversations with RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in Life, Love, Liberty, and Law. And Jeffrey Rosen has written a number of books, so you can look him up. And he's currently the CEO and president of the National Constitution Center. And we are starting the lightning round. Jeff, are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
You're ready. National Constitution Center, what does that mean to you?
It's the only institution in America chartered by Congress to disseminate information about the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. Check it out at constitutioncenter.org. It's the most rich and exciting learning platform about the Constitution in America, with videos, perspectives, podcasts from scholars from the right and the left, and you will learn from it every time you click on it.
Why did you develop the interactive Constitution, and what is it?
I just thought, and my colleagues did, that it was urgently important in America that there be a place that people from all perspectives can debate what they agree and disagree about the Constitution. And we have scholars from all sides writing about every clause of the Constitution. You can explore early drafts of every provision. And then we have this amazing tool that can unite classrooms across the country, from California to Philadelphia and everywhere in between, for hour-long discussions about the Constitution moderated live by federal judges and master teachers. It's a totally transformative learning platform.
How do people get there?
How do people get there? Just go online, constitutioncenter.org. You'll find it, and classrooms can sign up, and citizens can pick a clause that you don't know about. Pick an obscure one, like the Foreign Emoluments Clause or the Export-Import Preference Clause, and you'll just see there's so much to learn about all of them. It's amazing. It's gotten 30 million hits since it launched in 2015.
Wow, that's amazing.
And as a result, the Constitution Center is now the fifth most visited museum website in America and the seventh most in the world, just because people are Googling the Constitution and want to learn about it. It's such a great learning tool.
What a great advertisement. I think you need to pay us for that advertisement.
Well, I'm happy to do that.
That was wonderful. I'm kidding. We're nonprofit here.
Or people can send in donations.
People will send in donations. He's got all the answers. Okay, here's a real simple question, probably just yes or no, so it won't take long. How do you translate the Constitution in view of a changing society?
That's just short. Quick.
Yes and no. You know, the best example is Justice Brandeis in the wiretapping case. He said, of course, the founders didn't think about wiretapping, but we have to protect the same amount of privacy in the age of wiretapping as the framers took for granted. And that's why he said mental privacy is the core value, and we have to protect it whether or not there's a physical trespass. So many other examples. But just looking at the principles that the framers were trying to enshrine and then translating them into an electronic age is one of the crucial and most exciting challenges of our time.
That's a subject that we will have to get you back on the air to talk about, because as you noted, it's not a simple answer. Carrie's favorite here, Citizens United. Why?
What are
let me finish the sentence.
You are my favorite.
You know,
I love it. It scares me every time he says that.
We don't
every
have time.
Time.
Don't
oh,
listen
Lord.
To the question.
Oh, Lord.
Why did RBG say that was the worst decision ever?
Okay, that's a good one. That's a good one.
It's a great one. And she said that it was an affront to our democracy, and the claim that it would not undermine confidence in democracy, she believes, was completely unfounded.
If she is no longer able to continue as a justice before the next election, what will happen?
What will happen is President Trump will nominate a replacement within days of her stepping off the court, and that person will be confirmed by the Senate very quickly. And this could happen even if it happens after the presidential election. It's not inconceivable that if a Democrat won, then RBG were to leave the court and the Senate were still in session, President Trump might still appoint someone. So that's the state of affairs that we're at.
If that occurs before the election, how will Merrick Garland feel?
Well, he is such a good man and such a principled public servant. He'll keep his feelings to himself, but of course all of us would be quite indignant if we were in his situation.
Carrie?
I have a question about, and you may not know this, but what does RBG feel about, you know, what's happening in this country, especially with, you know, are you male, are you female, and especially dealing with kids and confusing them that way? To me, it's my opinion. It's like, well, you can figure out your gender when you get older. Does she have any say on that? Have you ever heard her talk about that?
You know, that's such an interesting question, and I have not talked about that issue with her. I would love to, and we're going to have one more conversation on December 12th in D.C., and it's another public conversation. Maybe I'll ask her, because that's a great question.
Oh, and if you need anybody to take notes, I.
Will there be a sequel to conversations with RBG, given the fact that you still have another conversation scheduled?
Well, we are shopping it around as a possible sort of documentary. So if anyone out in L.A. is interested in bringing this great story to life, then we'd be delighted to hear from them.
We have a lot of contact. We have a lot of contacts here, so we'll ask around. Quickly, another simple question, doesn't require a lot of time. The impeachment hearings, is it the right thing? What will happen?
Why don't we leave that for another show?
That's a whole other thing.
I knew I would get you. It took me all this time.
How many more questions do you have?
The Constitution Center did an amazing program, which is on our We the People podcast, which I want everyone to subscribe to because it's so exciting.
And you're the moderator of it. Let's make sure everyone understands, because they love hearing you. So if you want to hear more of Jeffrey Rosen, he's the moderator of We the People for the National Constitution Center podcast.
Well, it's definitely not about me, but it's a thrill for me to be able to call up the top liberal and conservative scholars in the country every week and walk out in great detail on the constitutional issues of the week. And we just did impeachment, and we had R&D congresspeople as well as R&D scholars, including Michael Gerhardt, who, of course, testified on Wednesday, and a conservative scholar. And they had one of the deepest discussions of what the framers thought about impeachment that I have heard.
What do you think is the greatest lesson you've learned from RBG? And when we talk about commitment, we've talked about that earlier. She did commit to talk in Omaha in August of 2020. That's something special. Hopefully that will take place. What do you say has, other than commitment, is what you've learned and what inspires you from RBG?
What we began with: overcome unproductive emotions and just do the work and think of others. It's just the hardest and most meaningful and most profound lesson in life. And achieving it is a daily challenge. And the fact that she achieves it so spectacularly well inspires me literally every day.
You know, life is cyclical. We started with that and we're going to finish with it because it's so inspiring. With a lot in between, what a great hour we spent with Jeffrey Rosen. We really appreciate you being with us here on Gervie's Law today. And we want to make sure that if people want to read more about the conversations that Jeffrey has had with RBG, they get the book, Conversations with RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Life, Love, Liberty, and Law. And they can get it anywhere that they usually get their books. Isn't that right?
Absolutely.
There's no choice place that you would rather them go, like go to the National Constitution Center website maybe? Or
no, absolutely. Any place you like to get books would be wonderful, and I hope you enjoy it in any form. The audiobook is really wonderful. The actors are spectacular, and we have bonus clips on the audiobook with the actual conversations between me and RBG, and just hearing her is the greatest inspiration I can imagine.
Awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
We appreciate it. Thanks for being with us. Happy holidays. Enjoy your December 12th conversation with RBG.
That's awesome.
And Carrie's going to be taking notes.
I am. I'm going to fly out there.
No, you can, please. I'd love if you came. I'll send you the details.
When you're,
I'm actually serious.
Well, okay. Yeah. I am too.
Okay. When you're in LA, stop by and we'll get that movie deal for you.
I would love that. Thank you both.
All right.
Okay.
Take care,
all right.
Jeff.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Wow. Carrie, you got a new friend.
I do. And I'm serious. I will fly out there. I mean, that would be amazing. That would just be something that's a once in a lifetime thing.
Well, yeah. You can contact him. I have his number. I'll give it to you after the show.
I will. And I'm going to sell his book, too.
You should.
I'm telling you.
Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. And we will see you next week right here on Gervie's Law and Talk Radio 790 KBC.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.